Welcome to Barnyard Language, honest talk about running farms and raising families. We are Katie and Arlene, an Iowa sheep farmer and an Ontario dairy farmer, with six kids, two husbands, and a whole lot of chaos between us.
While this is a podcast for farm families, sometimes our content isn't for the whole family. So kick off your boots, reheat your coffee, and join us for some Barnyard Language.
Welcome to Barnyard Language, and Katie's already sighing on her end, so I have a feeling that she has an update.
I was yawning. Sorry.
Oh, that was a yawn? All right. So yeah. That must mean there are lambs.
It does mean there are lambs. I was trying not to yawn directly into the mic. That seemed rude. Yes, there are lambs. There weren't any yesterday or so far today, but there were a bunch between Friday night and Saturday night, which was good. Everybody, knock on wood, is healthy and happy. And
no lambs in the house yet?
No lambs in the house yet. Had to pull two of them because they were huge, which is good. Everybody came through it okay. I didn't post it to social media. I needed to dry some lambs off and didn't have a towel out in the barn. So I gave them the shirt off my back, and I am now waiting for the Foggy Bottom boys to confirm what the warranty on their t-shirts is, although it seems to have washed up okay. So reminder, buy black t-shirts and always wear a sweatshirt so that you're not half naked in the cold.
Or bring some towels to the barn, one or the other.
Or, yes, yesterday I went to Walmart and I replaced all our bathroom towels because that's how I get more barn towels. I wait until the bathroom towels get ratty, then I send all of those out to the barn and I buy, and this is the important part, a very different color for the new bathroom towels. That is the key.
Right, from the previous. Yeah, that's a hot tip right there.
Yeah, and thankfully I'm not a decor in the bathroom sort of person where I would be concerned with things matching or what have you. So
nah, yeah, that's unnecessary.
Yeah,
just as long as the bathroom towel doesn't have placenta on it, that's the main thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's why we have washing machines, but it is nice not to think about where your towel's been when you're using it.
Yes, that's true.
Other than that, not much going on here.
Just the thing you've been waiting for weeks on end.
Just the thing I've been waiting for weeks.
And are they adorable?
Oh my God, you don't even know. I think that maybe there are other breeds of sheep that are less awesome than Katahdins. I feel like that's possible. But I caught a short video of some of our lambs trying to jump and buck and run when they were still new enough that they were still wet. So like less than 20 minutes old, we're trying to, you know, jump and play. And, the Katahdin ewes tend to be great mothers. The Katahdin lambs tend to be great nursers and very great at lambing, which is good. You know, ideally I don't want to see any of them.
Yeah. Those are good things to have when you're raising sheep.
The barn cameras have more than paid for themselves already in the not having to go outside in the middle of the night. Except when there are actual lambs that need actual assistance.
Sure. Yeah. Assistance, but, for sure.
Yep. So how are things at your place, Arlene?
Things are also good here. On the baby report, there is a new baby Jersey in the barn, and she is adorable. As yet unnamed, I'm going to put a poll in our Patreon for our supporters over on Patreon, because my daughter is having a really hard time picking a name. It is the B year, so we have three B names that she's narrowed it down to, but is having a hard time picking. So I'm not saying that the patrons are going to get to decide it necessarily, because it is her calf, but I will put the options there and they can vote on it. So at least she gets some more input on what her top choice is going to be. So mom's name is Peach and sister's name is Apricot. So that might give you a hint, but yeah, it's got to start with a B and it's not going to be Banana, because we've already decided that that is not a cute name.
I was legit just sitting here waiting for my chance to say Banana.
No, it's not going to be Banana.
I think it's a cute name. And Arlene, yes, I did think that you actually called me Heifer in that text where I asked the sex of the calf, because, folks, she wrote...
I was just answering the question.
What Arlene wrote was, they used sex semen, comma, heifer. And I was like, wow, that's harsh. And then I realized exactly what she meant was that we use a bull, they don't. They use AI, which makes it easier to know what you're going to get.
Yeah, not always. There's still a chance that it won't be a heifer, which is why I included heifer at the end, because you could still say they use sex semen and we got a bull, which is less fun. But yes, it was. Yeah, it is a little baby bee heifer calf. So, and it looks like she has mascara on. Her lashes are so dark and like she's got that the rings around her eyes. So cute and feisty. So
Jerseys do have ridiculous eyes. They really do. Like the whole.
Yeah. I mean, all babies are cute, but there's something about a baby jersey that's just so frigging adorable.
Yeah.
Probably comparable to sheep, I'm guessing.
The lambs are definitely cuter when they're like a week old, you know, once they've really like gotten their legs under them and gotten some fat on them and everything. And they're real.
Right. Fluffed up a little bit.
Real goofy. Can you tell our listeners about that poutine picture you sent me, Arlene? Because I need everyone to know about this.
Yes. Yeah. So we did go away a couple of days last week with just the boys and the family because it was their March break. So we went to Quebec City, which is about a 5-hour drive for us. So that's the capital of the province of Quebec and probably the capital of poutine. I don't know where poutine was actually invented, but it's on every single menu. And so there was one restaurant where one of the kids got poutine that had like dino nuggets and cheese sticks on it, like the deep fried cheese sticks along with the curd and the gravy. And then I ordered poutine.
And still the French fries?
Oh, yes. Yeah. The French fries are the critical piece. It's not poutine without the fries. And then the one that I got was fries with it was like bits of like pork belly. And on the menu, en français, it was like sausages wrapped in bacon. But when it arrived, it was just like bits of hot dog wrapped in bacon, but still delicious. And of course, cheese curds and gravy. So lots of pork products on top of my poutine. And it was delightful. And at that restaurant, I was feeling really proud of myself because they actually gave us French menus because in the like 3 seconds where I asked for a table of five in French, they thought that my accent was okay enough that they would actually give me French menus. But then once our waiter realized that we didn't actually understand what was on the menus, he brought the English ones over. But it was very nice. I felt like I had accomplished something just by being able to say that we needed a table for five.
Is the French menu thing sort of the equivalent of here if you go to some restaurants and they look at you and they put the chopsticks down and they bring you a fork? Is it sort of the same?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a touristy place. So, I mean, in other parts of the province, you wouldn't have the option of English menus. But in Quebec City, for sure, there's enough tourists and cruise ships and those types of things going through that they have to cater to those of us who don't understand much beyond that. That's a poutine. There's no translation required there.
Gotcha.
But yeah, we had a nice couple days. Went to an indoor water park. Three out of four kids were concerned about the fact that it was going to be cold for a water park. I'm not sure why all of them or three quarters of them were confused about the fact that it was going to be an indoor water park, and did some sightseeing. There's a big fort there, you know, to protect from the Americans. Never actually got used because it was built after the War of 1812, but we went to see the fort and all the big cannons and stuff up overlooking the St. Lawrence River. And it was very pretty, lots of old streets and cobblestones and horse-drawn carriages and all that kind of stuff. So it's very scenic. You know, as much scenic as you can do with three boys ages 16 to 9. So I would have enjoyed a little bit more just like wandering around alleyways and admiring the architecture. There was less of that, but there was food and being in a different location and not having to milk cows in the morning. So those are all great things too.
I feel like sometimes it's nice to go on vacation less exciting places because there's not that same pressure to like see everything where you're like,
right, yeah, or feel like I went all this way and I'm missing out.
Although, yeah, I bet that your three boys were not super excited to stand around and look at architecture and wander down random alleys.
No, that's true. But they were okay with the tour of the fort, which is something that I wanted to do. So that was good enough for me. Should we invite our guest on for this week?
Suppose we ought to.
Today, we're excited to be talking to Carmen Quaid, who got up extra early for us today because she's joining us from Australia. She's from New South Wales. So, Carmen, we start each of our interviews with the same question, and this is a way to introduce yourself to our listeners. So we always ask, what are you growing? So for our farmers, that can cover crops and livestock, but also includes kids and businesses and all kinds of other stuff. So, Carmen, what are you growing?
Oh, we're growing a few things here. So my husband and I have got 5 kids. They range from 6 up to 16 now. So easy to remember when they're 10 years from top to bottom. And we're predominantly cropping farmers. So we've got about, in partnership with my brother and sister-in-law, so we run about 10,000 acres or about a bit under 5,000 hectares in conjunction with them. And we also have sheep, so we're mixed farmers, and the sheep are probably a less important part of our total enterprise now, but they're still here, and we still really value them and really enjoy aspects of them and then other aspects yeah. not so much.
I enjoy aspects of my sheep too, Carmen. I get it.
Yeah, I think anyone who has sheep probably has the same sentiment. Yeah.
Oh, it's when they get into your garden or they decide to develop some new, never heard of before management or animal health condition. But no, they're we've mixed things up in the last few years and they've sort of got a little bit easier. So that's good.
And what kind of crops are we talking about?
So we call them winter crops. They might even be summer crops in your side of the world. So wheat, barley, and canola. And then the occasional legumes, so vetch or lupins or something else in rotation, either predominantly for nitrogen fixation rather than actually to strip.
So, Carmen, what's your ag background like? And did you grow up on a farm or is this a shocking new thing for you?
Oh, I'm too old for anything to be shocking or new. So, no, it's not something I grew up in. I grew up in Sydney. So that's, Australia's biggest city. We were in the suburban outskirts of that. So there was certainly some horticulture and some poultry around there, which really fascinated me, but we weren't directly involved. Some cousins had hobby farms. And I don't know, I just really liked it. I liked horses growing up. Haven't sort of had them as an adult, but really liked that aspect of the lifestyle and thought, oh, well, I'll go and study that at university. So I studied ag commerce about 3 hours from home. At uni there, and then that sort of led to jobs further out. I met my husband, and then here I am. So it's not an uncommon story, I don't think.
Yeah, falling in love with a farmer seems to be one of those one of the ways that people enter the industry, right? And then sometimes take on more roles too.
Yeah, I think so.
So we didn't actually cover it in the what are you growing, but you also have a business of your own. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, yes. I forgot about that. So, yeah, I've got a business called AgriFocus. So I've been doing it for five years, I'd been working as a lecturer at a university not far from home, and that was really great. So we're just dealing with undergraduate students, many of them from a farming background, and we were teaching sort of economics, accounting, farm management, but sort of that financial side of things and budgeting. And I just saw a gap in what they knew and they weren't applying at that time to what people who were sort of my peers in farming were trying to do and didn't have the education to do it. And we've got some great support at an industry level, at a government level for production sides of agriculture. So we have different field days and training opportunities that might look at, a particular rust issue in your wheat. And, that's an issue. So we've got this big field day on rust and everyone comes along and learns about how to manage rust and whatever else. It might be a mouse plague or whatever. Not so much for the business side of things. That's always been a bit of a gap. And I started up a little training business. And I started it up because I was doing my budget for our farm and I thought, oh, gee, that's not looking that good this year. How can I make a little bit of extra money? So ironically, that's how it started. And it's become really for me, really successful. I've really enjoyed it. I've learned a lot. I've continued to learn, and that was something that didn't happen teaching undergraduate students because they didn't have a lot of life experience or practical experience to bring to the table. Whereas when you're working with other farmers, they've got their own way of doing things, or they have a different perspective or a different industry. And I found that has been incredibly valuable, both for AgriFocused as a business and also for my own farming business.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because even if people don't have a business background necessarily, they develop ways to run their offices and keep track of things and do all those types of the business aspect of the side. And I love the concept of your business, because so many farmers end up in farming because they love farming, not because they necessarily want to be, you know, business owners, or they love doing the taxes at the end of the year, or keeping track of the books. But that is such a huge part of what we have to end up doing as business owners.
Well, and Arlene, I don't know how it is in Canada and Australia, but I know here at least there's an assumption that the wife will take care of the bookkeeping, even if the wife also did not want to be a bookkeeper, and also if the wife does not have time to be the bookkeeper or have any, you know, there's just an assumption that being female will magically grant you powers of bookkeeping that will just like...
Right, that you've got these skills somehow in your... Yeah, that's right.
Descend upon you, you know, somewhere between marriage and motherhood, you are just blessed with magic mathematical and filing skills.
I think it's certainly the same here. Like, it's a hugely gender stereotyped field of farming. And look, for some of us, for some time, that sort of makes a lot of sense. And I'm glad when I was 9 months pregnant, I wasn't doing 10-hour shifts on the tractor, or and I could just sit in front of my computer and I could contribute that way, and that was great. And the same thing, you know, when you've got little kids underfoot, you're not having to spend heaps of time in the yards to sort of make a contribution that way. I could do it in the comfort of my own home and pop a baby into bed and lay some toys out for the toddler, and that I like that aspect of it. So in that sense, it made a lot of sense for me to do that, and that's the background I came in with. For some people who haven't got that background, what you hear them saying a lot of the time is, I'm not good at that, or I'm a nurse and I can't do that, or I've got a background in PR and I can't do that. Not forgetting that they weren't born a nurse and they weren't born into PR. They acquired those skills by study and by practice and by applying themselves, and they got better at it progressively as they developed through. And I think it's the same with the bookwork and with any sort of business side, business management side. You have to learn it and you have to put the time into developing your skills, whether you do that formally, informally, in a mixture of, you know, short courses and just applying those skills and checking back in. But you do have to put the effort in to learn things, and the rewards come. Things get quicker, they get easier, you find it more fulfilling. It's great.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure there are a lot of differences between our countries in terms of, you know, the details, but what are some of the major issues that you think that farmers face when it comes to the office side of their work? Some of the things that are kind of the common, not mistakes necessarily, but the common things that people struggle with, or yeah, maybe mistakes or things that they could do better.
I think the gap in budgeting tends to be a big one, and that leads to people not having a really good awareness of where they're at any point in time. So that can manifest in two ways, I guess. One way is that they think they've got more money than they have, so they go out and do things that they can't necessarily in the short to medium term afford, even though from a business case perspective it might be able to be relatively, you could justify it. There's a business case, it makes sense, but for them, for that business at that time, they can't afford it. The other aspect of it, and this is probably a little bit more disappointing, is that people don't take opportunities because they don't think they can finance it, when in reality, financing it is something that they could do with ease. And as long as it meets all of those other parameters from a business case perspective, they should be charging ahead with it. So both of those, I think, tend to get people in a little bit of a trap, and they might not realize it either. So it's one of those you don't know until you know type things. You're coasting along thinking, oh, things are really, really tough when they're not, or things are really, really good when they're not. It's just that sort of unknown side of it.
Yeah, and it's hard to make decisions if you don't have the full scope or full knowledge of what your financial situation actually is.
Definitely. And I think that not making a decision tends to become the default. So it's not like you consciously make a decision to do a certain thing or not do a certain thing. You just coast in this mode. And I often talk about how it's not about, often as a farmer, you're sitting there going, oh, well, look, this is a 7 out of 10 outcome. Nothing's ever perfect. There's never any perfect solution or ever any perfect thing to do at any perfect time. This is about a 7 out of 10 way to deal with this issue. This is a 7.5 out of 10 way to deal with this issue. And I'm so torn between the two because no one seems totally advantageous over the other, and neither is a perfect fix, that I do nothing. And doing nothing is a 3 out of 10. And that decision paralysis can often be exacerbated by the fact that you might not have all of that financial information in front of you at any one time. Or if you do, you might be lacking some of the skills to actually really analyze it. So perhaps, you know, you're looking at things over a too short a period of time. Maybe you're looking at things over too long a period of time.
So, Carmen, I'm wondering what advice you have. I feel like a common issue in our area, at least, is that people think, well, our farm's not big enough to need to do financial stuff. Or, you know, we don't want to think about X, Y, and Z, so we're not going to do it. I know a horrifying number of people who don't do any estate planning, any wills or anything, because they don't want to think about what might happen. So if we just don't think about it, then nothing is ever going to happen. And, you know, it's really scary. And you know, as someone who calms their anxiety by thinking of worst case scenarios and then coming up with solutions for them, I find it really terrifying that people are like, well, you know, for instance, our lawyer said something about, you know, what happens if my husband and his folks are in an accident together, you know, so we lose, there's not just that fallback of another adult generation. Like what, you know, yes, it is tremendously unlikely, thank God. But, you know, nobody plans for these things being like, I feel like there's probably a really good chance that this is going to happen. So we ought to plan for it, you know, rather than it's not like it's just not going to happen if we refuse to plan what to do if it does happen.
Definitely. Look, there's so much going on there. And that, so initially you mentioned scale. So businesses that think that because of their scale, there's not really a case. They might not even see themselves as a business. You know, they're, oh, it's a farm and, you know, it's our farm and it's our passion, it's our heritage and it's our lifestyle and it's all of these, you know, motherhood statements. But in reality, unless you're incredibly wealthy, you can't really go on through your life thinking that. And like I talked about before, it's that sort of both the upside and the downside. There could be opportunities that you could be actually taking advantage of that you're not because you don't think you're of a sufficient scale to do it. And there could be things that are potentially worse and in the long term or in the medium term are going to have really big implications on your lifestyle, on your family, on your heritage, on your farm because you are ignoring them. So I think that regardless of your scale, those things are really, really important. You might find it easier to do them if the business isn't particularly complex, but people avoid it, and they avoid it for the same reason that they avoid the whole succession, making a living plan, making a dying plan, because the answer could be confronting. And it's not the analysis, perhaps, that might be holding them back in that case, or the fear of doing the analysis or the inability to do the analysis. When you talk to people, quite often it's about how confronting the information might be when they have it sitting in front of them. And we've all felt like that. You think, oh, I just don't want to have a look at that now. I'm not in the state of mind where I can really, really sit down with those books right now and have a look at what things are going to look like in 2 or 3 months' time. We've all done that. So you do avoid it for a time, but as you said, Kate, avoidance. It leads into anxiety. That sort of avoidance manifests in higher levels of anxiety. So that, yeah, the succession planning thing's an issue very much here. It's been an issue for a really, really long time. It will continue to be an issue. I think people have got a little bit better at it, but there's so much tied up in it. You know, how we feel about ourselves, how we feel about what we've achieved in our life, how we feel about our adult children, and how we feel and how that reflects back on us as parents of adult children. I think sometimes parents get to the stage where they think perhaps some parents, this is not all of them, some parents feel like they haven't done a very good job. And then they're trying to make some sort of changes and make a very good job of parenting, done a very good job of leaving a legacy, accumulating wealth, all of the things that they've wanted to do. So putting that off feels like they get a little bit of extra time to do that. And you definitely see adults, parents trying to parent adult children in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, which is just horrible when you see it from the outside. So those things are, important, crucially important. If you ignore them, they don't go away. They just make it a lot harder for whoever ends up getting left behind. And it often, from a succession point of view, it often damages that younger generation and hampers their opportunities. So it puts pressure on their marriages, it puts pressure on their finances. So you end up, it ends up becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, the families that are sitting out there thinking, I don't think my kids are up to the job, or I think their marriage is going to fall apart, or I think financially they can't handle this. Well, then they don't get the responsibility, so they don't develop the financial skills, they don't have financial security, and the dynamic in the family is not right, and that puts huge pressure on their marriages, so their marriages fall apart. And all of these things tend to self-perpetuate. The business doesn't grow because the people that are making the business decisions aren't the people that are young and dynamic with new energy and new ideas and taking on new technology. They're still being made by people who are operating in the mindset of potentially a generation ago. So all of these things go wrong that they were fearing. Why? Potentially because they were fearing them and they didn't put those things in place to overcome the fear for that sort of natural progression to take over. I don't know if that's something that you see, Kate and Arlene, in your communities.
Podcasts are free to listen to, but they aren't free to create. Katie and I would appreciate your support as we work to build the Barnyard Language community.
Patreon is an easy way for you to make a contribution that goes directly to making the show. As a member of our Patreon community, you get to watch the video version of our weekly updates, complete with questionable hairstyles and clutter. With three levels of support, you can choose a tier that works for you.
Keep the podcast going by becoming a patron today at patreon.com/barnyardlanguage.
Now you've just opened up a whole lot more questions. I know you saw my little one back there. He's almost six. His big sister is seven. And I'm wondering, I was thinking this morning, actually, as I was listening to my kids argue about which toys they were going to buy, about how we raise kids and farm kids, especially, to know about money and to be, how to teach them about that balance between being conservative with money so you have that cushion, but also being ready to make big investments when it's time to make big investments, or being ready to make that jump on selling crops. I know I read an article recently about how women statistically are better at selling crops on the market than men are, because men are always convinced that they can get a better price. Generally, statistically, men are always waiting for that market to go up 2 cents more. And so overall, they lose money because they're always trying to get a little bit more, where women are much less emotionally tied to it and can say, this price is pretty damn good, I'm jumping on it, get me out of here before all hell breaks loose, you know? And so how do we raise our kids to, and also to just not be those people who never have any fun? Because I know those people too, that, you know, they save and save and save and save and save, and they never do anything to enjoy all the work they've done, you know? And that doesn't have to be an expensive thing, but it generally implies some outlay at least.
Yeah, look, I think you're right. It, and what you're talking about is raising these kids that take a balanced approach to finance and use it as a tool.
Yeah, so you two parents of big kids, tell the rest of us how to do this, please.
Well, look, I think it's not just a one-off thing, is it? It's just, firstly, I think modelling things yourself and making them really aware. Like, everyone talks about pocket money and all of this sort of stuff. And, you know, you do that and you have your little ways of doing that within your family. But I think one thing that tends to get ignored is actually talking to your kids about the decisions that you're making yourself. And they might be household decisions, or they might be farm decisions, or they might be somewhere in between. It's, you know, that trade-off that we talk about, we have going on in our own head. You know, I could buy this item and that's higher quality, but it might be a little bit more expensive. And that means I have to do without this and this and this in the short term, but in the long term it's better. Or, you know, in this scenario, let's buy this because it's easy, or let's do this. So articulating those things, having those conversations out loud, whether it's in the supermarket, in the office, around the kitchen table, in the ute, in the car or whatever, is so, so important and often overlooked. But then, yes, through pocket money, through their own little farm businesses or their own having their own sheep or having their own steer or whatever else, giving them an opportunity to experience that from a business perspective and actually talking about those business costs as well, so they get a really good understanding of what the variable costs of production are. And then talking about those overhead expenses that we're all facing that they don't see. So they might see a truck of feed come in and know that you pay for that. They might see the fuel truck come in and they know you're paying for that, but they really don't realise some of those other things, particularly around debt, around interest, around payments for things and what they are like in the long term. So I haven't been perfect. I remember one of the kids was banging on about something and I was cranky and I had the fertilizer bill there and it was horrendous. And I said, what are you stressing me out about that for? I've got to worry about this. This is what I'm worried about. And banged it down on the table and he saw the numbers and they were frightening and not frightening for me. They're obviously very frightening for him. And he came back a day or two later going, Mum, I think we should sell the farm. What are you talking about, mate? Oh, because of that fertilizer bill. It was nowhere near, like, you know, stressful, whatever else, but not unexpected, not hard to manage. It was just big.
Right, but he had no context for what that meant in you know, relative to the size of your farm or what your income was or anything, right? Yeah.
No, so it was that was very poorly done on my part. But, yeah, so we've just really tried to include our kids with that. With those sorts of things all the way along. But I think the other thing to be teaching them too is the privacy aspect of it. You know, what is it that we talk about outside of our family? What is it we talk about outside the house? You know, these things are personal, they're private, they're nothing to be ashamed of, but they're not something that you talk to your schoolmates about or the neighbours if they ask or anybody else. So,
yeah, finding that balance when it's a family business is a little tricky too, right? Where you want to be open with them. But sometimes our finances also include other people, right? You know, whether it's your parents, in-laws, siblings, you know, other families. So it's tricky to have discussions around money. And sometimes that intergenerational part is tricky too. I was thinking about the people who end up in that office administrator role who maybe got trained by a previous generation who got trained by a previous generation, and none of them, you know, maybe came into it with any official training, and you learn from the person who had the books before you, and then you do it the way that they did. I was thinking about, what if someone is in that role and they want to actually evaluate the way that they're doing something and not start over necessarily, but look at whether what they're doing is actually effective or not? Are there any kind of first steps? I'm kind of jumping around back to, you know, like adults versus kids, but that was something that came up when we were talking about, you know, like the people who end up running the books maybe don't always have the skills or maybe don't take the courses to really know what they're doing, but they're like, well, this is how my mother-in-law did it, so I'll just keep on the same track.
Look, I think the first place to start is often your accountant, or if you've got a business advisor, they're a really good place to start because they know your business, they know what the tax and compliance issues are for you. And I think that first step is to make sure that you are compliant, and they're probably best placed to give you that sort of feedback. And then it's about going that little bit further. People don't peer-to-peer learn so much with this sort of finance stuff, and that's unfortunate. And it probably leads back to that whole social thing. It is private information. We don't really want to talk about the dollars too much with other people. But sometimes you can find a good confidant that maybe you're not talking specifically about the dollars, but you're quite happy to talk about the general terms of financial setups, who they might want to talk to, how you lay things out on your computer. They give you a copy of a spreadsheet they use without any data in. So finding sort of a peer in the industry, in your district, maybe even out of your district, can be really, really useful. And then just looking to see what you've got around. So I know that in the States, Iowa State University does a lot of extension work, and there's some brilliant stuff available online. And I think they seem to be doing face-to-face training in some areas as well. So we don't actually have that. Our universities tend not to do extension work directly to farmers. We've got other levels of government and other farmer groups that tend to provide all of that sort of stuff. But there's online courses available, and there's a lot of information out there. So that's what we actually, well, I started doing with my AgriFocus business, because the travel distances in our area are long, and people have got such varied commitments on farm, off farm work, kids, everything else. So I wanted to be able to provide them that opportunity to do things from home and study online and learn new skills online, so that they didn't necessarily have to take that time away from farm to travel to actually learn that way. But it, you know, it's a trade-off. I think that learning in that classroom environment is so valuable, and learning alongside other people is really, really valuable. And as much as doing things online live and is great and perhaps better than video stuff online, it's never, never the same as being in a room with someone and being able to talk to them.
Carmen, that actually leads perfectly into my next question. I live in Iowa. I went to Iowa State. I did the Ames Project program, which is a fantastic program designed to get women up to speed on the business side of farming. And for me, one of the real benefits of enrolling in a class, or even, you know, doing it online, but paying someone and having a set committed time, is that I'm fairly sure this isn't just our family, but things like, we really need to get caught up on the books, get said a lot of times before anybody actually sits down and does it. And, you know, it's the same as, I'm going to call this out for my husband, sharpening the blades on the lawnmower. I've been hearing about it for 11 years now. We're on, I think, the third lawnmower. I don't know that the blades have ever actually gotten sharpened. I am just as responsible for that as he is, because we are both grown adult humans who can do things like that. Anyway, we're getting to that season. So I'm wondering what strategies you have for things actually getting done, instead of them just staying on that list of shit we ought to do until the tax preparer says, where are your papers? And then in hypothetical families that I've heard of, people are digging around under the seat of the truck. Our family, of course, does not do this. Everything we own is very neatly filed away in file folders at all times. But, you know, you end up digging for receipts or having to call people for copies of stuff or whatever. So what do you advise for breaking this horrifying cycle of horrifyingness?
Look, I think there's lots of little strategies and things and tips and tools and IT solutions to all of those problems. But realistically, they all lead back to this task and these jobs being rated as less important than anything else. And then they get pushed into the margins. So they get pushed into the sort of stuff we do on the weekends or after dinner or, you know, really late at night or on a rainy day, and we wait for this perpetual rainy day. We're in a low rainfall district. You might be waiting for snow days or something, but we wait for this rainy day where we can't do anything else, and we'll do our bookwork then, and we'll catch up on it all over then. And they don't happen in enough frequency. We don't get enough rain and we don't get enough time to then work on that business side.
If your family's like ours, you would need like a straight up monsoon season at this point to deal with the stuff that's been left for a rainy day.
So I think once we make it a higher value, it's easier to say, I'm going to sit down on the 15th day of the month and the 28th day of the month or every second Tuesday, and I'm actually going to make some time to do this role. The other thing about women doing it is it gets pushed back even further, because you say women are very rarely paid for this role that they perform on farm. Now, that might be less relevant when you're a husband and wife business and you've got some shared finances and you have that feeling that you're all contributing to the greater good. It's less, it doesn't work where you're in a broader family business where there's multiple people involved, or the succession arrangements haven't been put in place, so you're essentially working for free, contributing to the wealth that may or may not be yours at some time. So I think we're valuing, again, if we pay the people that are doing this work in our businesses, that's got to be a really good start to them saying, okay, well, look, I am going to make this a priority, because on essence or on balance, this makes more sense than me taking an extra shift at work or doing an extra day at work or taking on another contract of off-farm work.
Or paying for a babysitter for the day so that you can actually spend, you know, consecutive hours doing it and not 15 minutes here and 30 minutes there.
Yeah, and look, certainly that's how I started, actually putting my hand up and saying, I think I need to be paid for this work. I didn't, I got to the point where I began to, this is sort of, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I was getting to the point where I was beginning to resent it. I was paying for childcare to sit at home to do this work. So it was coming at a net cost to my household. And it just wasn't a positive thing at all. And I was giving up paid work to take it on, whatever. So then I put my hand up and said, look, I think I really need to be paid, and explained circumstances. And everyone went, oh, never thought of it like that. It was not an issue. Like, of course, you're working. This is important. We don't want to do it. They definitely didn't want to take it on themselves.
Yeah, that's right. Or they're going to have to outsource it and pay someone else somewhere else and then do the work of transferring information to them and all the communication that goes into hiring someone else to do it.
Exactly. So once that conversation was had, no one else put their hand up for the job. And then I got paid for it. And that, I think, was a big shift, because then I could see it as a job. And then everybody else could see the value in it as well. And it's probably not reflective of what it would be worth on commercial terms, but I think it's a really important thing to be paid for the work, and then to set aside regular days, rain, hail or shine, to work on it.
So while we're on that topic of being paid for work, we were talking about kids and working into, you know, financial management and all that kind of stuff. Do you have some examples of ways that people are incorporating their kids into farm businesses, whether that's being paid for work or having them set up their own little enterprises, those types of things that are working well? Or what are your thoughts on how we, if our kids are interested, how we can incorporate them into the business and not just do the, well, you know, this is, and I know every situation is different, but sometimes it can be the, well, you just have to do it because this is a family farm and this is what we do. And I mean, that's one way to approach it. But if we're working towards them having their own finances and understanding finances, then they have to kind of understand the money aspect too. So do you have any ideas or things that you've seen that have worked for other people?
I think paying kids is important, perhaps less for the sort of under eights, but about eight and up. And as they become, and they get to that point, you know, you tell them how wonderful they are for when they're really, really little and how terribly good they worked and they're just useless.
Give them a sticker. That's all it takes.
I know. But they're useless and they're hopeless. And then it gets to the point where you're going, gee, you did a good job, and you actually mean it. Like, in comparison to having somebody else there doing the job, they get to that point where you go, wow, I couldn't have done that job as quickly or as well without their help. But once they get to that point, paying them is really, really important. And it's really, really important because all children are different. And they're different in terms of their interest in farm work, and they're different in terms of their work ethic. And it's very difficult to then reward them adequately or be fair between siblings if you're not paying them formally. So you decide to pay them in, you know, oh, this one gets a motorbike because he works so hard on the farm and this one doesn't work so much and she gets nothing. And that, or no one gets paid and this one works really hard and he does nothing, that becomes, I think, fraught with danger. And the older they are, the more important that becomes. So they get into those later teen stages where they really are really, really, really useful. And if you're not paying them, they go off and find somebody else that does pay them. So starting that early and actually rewarding them.
And if you started training them at 9, then you want to capitalize on your investment too in the training that you've done.
Yeah. So they've got really, really good and they go off and want to work for someone else. So I think paying them for their work's really good. Doesn't have to be a huge amount, and you'll have different ways about whether that's done formally through a wage system or informally with pocket money type situation, and that'll depend on your business and what your accountant says and whatever else, but that's really, really important. And then a lot of them are quite entrepreneurial and they like starting up their own little egg business or their own fat in a few steers or do whatever they want to do, and those things I think really need to be encouraged. They tend to be a lot of work for parents. A lot of work for parents. So it's not for the faint-hearted, and it's certainly not for a particularly busy season of your life or the particularly busy time of year. But those things are great because it's not just the finance side of things, it's the marketing side of things, it's everything else. So it's a great thing to sort of encourage them into that side of things as well.
I know for our 13-year-old, he started cutting some lawns last year started off with just my mother-in-law. And then one of the neighbors saw that he was doing her lawn and asked if he could do theirs. And so one thing that we worked out was that he was getting paid, but then he had to give us some of that money for the use of the lawnmower and for the gas, because we wanted to make sure that he realized that it wasn't 100% profit business, because he didn't actually buy that lawnmower that he was using or the fuel that was going into it. So I think that, yeah, there are ways to encourage their entrepreneurial spirit and their desire to earn money and to work, but to make sure that they don't end up earning more than we do in the end too.
Definitely, Ali. My son, when he was, oh, I don't know, 9, I think, had a little stall at the market selling soup. And he made about $350, and that was great. And we ran into a cousin down there, and he was saying, oh, I made $350. And he looked over at us and he said, well, that's probably about how much you've dropped on this. So basically, you know, we're paying for the ingredients. We're running him in town, driving him out of town, setting all this stuff up, paying the storeholder fee. But look, I think those things, that they're a lot of fun, and they're huge in terms of their self-esteem building as well. So giving them opportunities to succeed at that sort of stuff and setting them up so that they do go reasonably well, or if they fail, they're really clear on the reasons why. That's sort of also important. And that goes back to, you know, is there a demand for this that you're trying to sell? Do you have sales channels out there? Is it making a decent enough margin on what it's costing you? Yeah, that sort of thing.
Well, and Carmen, it seems like with the differences in how modern farm businesses are running, there's a lot more opportunities for kids who might not be outdoorsy, agricultural, hands-on equipment and livestock minded. That, you know, if your kid can read, they should be able to do at least basic filing, I would think. And, you know, if they get older and are interested in doing websites or doing social media or doing whatever, you know, there's that much more opportunity for them to be productive and to be part of the business and to look at all these other things. I know when we started doing direct marketing, we had some lack of shared understanding with my in-laws, because we had to put a name on the farm, you know, because when you're selling at farmer's market, there has to be a name on things. And it's changed so much in the last two generations that, you know, when my in-laws were milking, you grew your feed and you fed it to your cows and you milked your cows, and then the creamery gave you a check. And hopefully that check was more than what you had spent on putting feed in your cows. And that was it, you know, I mean, because obviously milking cows is super duper simple and nothing bad ever happens and it's really straightforward. And Arlene is just laughing and laughing over here. But now, you know, if you're direct marketing and you've got sales to customers and you've got licensing to deal with and you've got bookkeeping and insurance and websites and social media and on and on and on. And all of that is more opportunities for our kids to find things they love to do that might make them money and can at least hopefully be useful to the rest of the family.
Definitely. Definitely. And I'm seeing certainly older children, so this is sort of university age and beyond, that are now contributing in this finance or management or bookkeeping side of things remotely. So I was talking to one fellow the other day and he was saying how his daughter's helping out with these sorts of things. And I said, oh, where's your daughter now? He said, oh, she's, you know, in this town, she's studying allied health. And you go, oh, wow, isn't that great? So she's chosen a different career path totally, but she's actually remained making a contribution to their farm from 3 or 4 hours from home. And that was just great to see, and picking up these skills that will no doubt help her in whatever she chooses to do in her life, because they are very much transferable skills. And they're really practical, important things. And that, yeah, that social media, that marketing things, that these generations coming through that are digital natives are often going to be better at their parents and that sort of thing, and have a really good feel for the market, I think, especially teenagers, because they're so incredibly self-conscious and they're so incredibly good at mirroring the people around them, that they have this the eye for things to say, look, that doesn't look good, that doesn't sound good, this is the way that, you know, other people seem to have achieved success in that industry, perhaps you should consider doing it like that. They don't say it, Kate, in such measured, beautiful terms once they get a little bit older.
Yeah, we just get told we're doing it wrong.
Yeah, that's wrong. That looks stupid. Why would you do it like that? Yep.
Yeah.
They're brutal.
So while we're talking about our kids, maybe we'll transition into some of our more parenting focused questions, because as a both ag and parenting podcast, we like to talk about both sides of what's going on the farm. So one of the things we end up talking a lot to, I think women especially, about is that transition from not being a parent to becoming a parent, the changes. I mean, obviously there's physical changes, but also the mental change and the life change that goes along with that. So I know it was a few years ago for you. You said your oldest is 16, but what do you reflect on now about what that time was like from pre-parenthood to becoming a mom?
Oh, my house was so clean, Arlene. And not that that's terribly important to me now, but gee, it was nice. And that's one thing you look when you look back on those photos of just, you know, they might be just a picture of you around the house or some people have come over and you look in the background, you go, oh, look how clean it was. It was so tidy. There was nothing on the floor. So I think it's just that whole loss of control thing, isn't it? And you go from, you know, being this, people having kids later, I was in my late 20s, so you've had really a decade of independence and autonomy over most aspects of your life, and you go to being totally out of control again. And I think a lot of us find that you've got this sort of feminist mindset of women can do anything and you're equally capable of doing anything that any man would do, and you're shoved right back into these 1950s gender roles. Because they, you know, for lots of ways, for women with very little children, they serve them well in the short term, but it can be a really uncomfortable pushback into this mode of being that, you know, the cook, the washerwoman, the house cleaner, the baby looker afterer, and then all of the work of perceived value is being done by somebody else. So I think that, that loss or downsizing of offsizing of off-farm work can be a real shock, and it certainly was for me. But you settle into that new stage of life and you make it your own, and then you barely remember what it was like, I guess. You're used to being so totally out of control and not getting anything done that it becomes normal and you don't, I think, grieve it so much.
Yeah, that's an important word, though. I mean, there is grieving in that, in the realizing that there's no going back. That you have to embrace the fact that this is the new normal, and that, yeah, that sense of control that you thought you had is it's kind of gone.
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's a positive growth hard, isn't it? No one's in control of their own lives. And I think that's something that we're sort of probably more attuned to as farmers than other people are, because we're so dependent on the weather, we're so dependent on markets, we're so dependent on things that are entirely out of our control. And from a financial point of view, we talk about budgeting, we talk about all of those things. Wouldn't it be easy if the same amount of money rolled in every week? It's just so, this is like budgeting on steroids.
Or even every season.
Yeah, definitely.
But it's, if you knew that the crop that you put in was going to result in a certain amount at the end of the season, would be pretty nice. But yeah, that's not the life we're in. Yeah. So as a mom of many kids, how do you try to, I know there's no such thing as balance, but how do you try to balance the needs of that many different personalities and people in your home?
I think it's become more of a balancing act between the needs of different ages and the needs of different personalities. I think different personalities is probably easier to manage if they're not all really passionate about the same thing. So you can give them individual attention or individual relationship about the things that they're interested in, and have those little moments for connection about whatever they're particularly into at that time. It's just managing the needs of, say, a 16-year-old versus a 9-year-old. That's the tricky thing.
I've got two of those, yep.
Yeah. I think I find that really tricky. And I think I found that really tricky too that as you have more kids, when they're all really little, you were just adding another little kid. So you just had 5 little kids whose needs were fairly similar in terms of food and bedtimes and social opportunities and everything else. But as they get older and the older ones want to go to parties and they're getting their licenses and they're doing all of these sorts of things, you've still got this poor little kid at the end that's getting dragged along here, there and everywhere, that's getting to bed so late at night, having meltdowns. It's through the school holidays, it's sort of a little bit free range for us here. And the kids, the bigger kids all get their own food. They get lunch, they get their some breakfast, they're waking up, some of them are waking up at 7:30, someone else is waking up at 11. And the little one came up to me and she just had this meltdown. And I'm going, what's wrong? Something tragic had happened. And I said, oh, look, how about we have some lunch? And she said, I haven't even had breakfast yet.
That has definitely happened in my house too.
So you just go, oh, this poor child's not even getting fed. So that, I think that I have found – difficult is that just that space, that different needs related to their particular age, and trying to accommodate or run a household that suits a 6-year-old and a 16-year-old and all the other ones in between.
I know I had a moment the other day where people were going in different directions and I realized that I hadn't accounted for the fact that the 9-year-old couldn't stay home alone by himself, because usually there's just an older sibling around. The others are all big enough that they can stay with him. But everyone had plans in different places. It was like, oh, you actually have to go with one of us because we can't just leave you. And of course he was like, I'm fine. Just leave me. I'm good. And it was like, no, I don't think we're quite at that stage. If dad's just in the barn, sure, it's steps away. But if we're all away from the farm, I think that you're going to actually have to get in one of these vehicles and go along.
This is the part that cracks me up as the parent of two that are so close in age, is that people act like this is such a hard thing. And I'm like, you have to do twice as much of each thing you do, but you only have to do the one thing. They eat the same kind of stuff. Right now they're in the same size clothes.
Yeah, they're going to the same place every day.
Yeah, they go to the same school. They go to the same daycare. They go to the same sports. They have the same friends. Yes, it's tremendously loud because neither of them has an inside voice, and it's real busy and there's a lot of crying, but they're doing it at the same time and neither of them's going, but I have to go to work, and there's no baby. And I don't know. I think this is easier.
And I think, Kate, you're in the golden stage of two primary school age children. It's the golden stage. No babies. Everyone's pretty self-sufficient. But at the same time, they're still very, very family orientated at that age. And mum and dad and home are the most important things in their lives. And it's, I think, just a really lovely, all the stages are fun. And I think they're all, the teenage stuff, everyone, everyone complains about it, but far out, they're funny. They are just so funny. Like, my kids have got a good sense of humor, but they're also sometimes their naivety is just hilarious about how they assume the world works and how they think everything's just going to happen for them, like with very little effort or impulse or on their part. Like, it's just, I think that
that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. It'll be fine. Why are you stressing, Mom?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you might have to make a few phone calls, mate, because that just won't automatically happen on its own.
I'm not sure all those details are going to align, but sure, let's try that.
No, they're really cute.
I feel a little bad for my husband because, you know, on weekends or sometimes even after school, he'll want to like go out to McDonald's for supper or whatever. And the kids will say, no, we'd rather stay home. And he'll say, but there's ice cream, there's toys, and like there's no bribe big enough to get them back out of the house and into the car. Like, they're happy to even go play outside, but once they're home, they're done. You know, and I'm just like, sorry, buddy. They're not the little social butterflies you were.
We're about 45 minutes from town. And then anything, so our local town's got 3,500 people, so there's a lot of things that you can't get there. So then we've got to go to a bigger town, which is sort of over an hour or a couple of hours away. And, yeah, the kids are just going, Mary, she's going, Mum, I've got no clothes, and she's got no clothes. And I said, come with me to Griffith, we'll go and get some clothes. And she said, oh, no, I don't want to go that far. It's too far in the car. I just want to stay at home. You're going, well, how are we going to get the clothes?
We can order things, but you're not going to be able to try them on until they arrive on the doorstep.
No. So, yeah, mine are the same.
Carmen, that was actually part of the motivation for this show, too, was how many people I ran into in parenting groups who were like, well, there's XYZ at school tomorrow, so I'll just, you know, pop out to Target and grab whatever. I'm like, our closest Target's an hour and a half away. So... you're like, yeah, we have a Walmart within half an hour, but it's a small town Walmart. So, you know, let's talk about your options there.
It can be a little bit convenient sometimes, Kate, because you can push the we're too far out of town car button. Yeah. just not do it.
Yeah, the budget wise, it's like, well, can't buy it because we can't even get there. Yeah.
No. And look, that's a huge pressure we see, but and I don't know how. Like you mentioned, Arlene, that you're not too far from town, but it's a huge pressure to think that your kids are missing out. So, you know, there's town kids, they're the kids that you're friends with, they're there all the time. So they're doing three or four different things after school, sports and different activities and whatever else, and your kids are interested in them too, and you just sort of feel a little bit torn. Sometimes they are nagging about doing more things, but I've become very conscious of the fact that we can't do it all. You know, my kids aren't going to be excellent swimmers because we live too far away from the pool, and my kids aren't going to be excellent at this, and they might miss out on opportunities to do the little art class after school that they would really love because we live out here, and we've got to see that as a privilege rather than a deficit and really live and make sure that they experience all the good things about living out here. And if we're not really conscious of it, or if I'm not really conscious of it as a mum, they could quite happily sit in front of the television all day. So it's about saying, your dad's down the paddock, why don't you jump on the motorbike and go down and see what he's doing? You know, why don't you go for a walk in the scrub? Why don't you go? Once you get them out and they're really enjoying it, but it does have to be I just have to make really sure that I'm not essentially raising suburban kids who stay entirely in the house yard in a rural environment. The suburban kids are okay because they get all the other add-ons, the swimming lessons and the art classes and riding their bikes to their friends' houses and doing all of those great stuff. But if my kids just stay in the house yard, they miss out twice. They miss out on the farm stuff and they miss out on the town stuff too. So as they've got a little bit older, it's, yeah, I don't know. Some kids, I was chatting in like a farmers group the other day and I said, you get farm kids come in three types. You get Kelpies, which are our Australian working dogs. You get Kelpies, and the Kelpies are like out the door and on the back of the ute before the bosses even started it up, and they're just dead keen and they're really efficient. They're fantastic and they make everyone's life easy. And then you get Labradors, And Labrador farm kids just stay in the house yard, and they're beautiful, and they're always happy to see you when you get home, and they've just got such a pleasant nature that everybody loves to be around them. And then some people get Jack Russells, and the Jack Russells are just like mad, and wherever they go, they cause absolute chaos.
Arlene has a Jack Russell.
Jack Russell child, Arlene, or a Jack Russell dog?
Possibly both. I've got a dog, but I'm waiting to hear this description.
So the Jack Russell farm kids are the ones that, like, they're just so keen to be involved in all the farm stuff, but they have absolutely no natural instinct. And whenever they are in the shed or down the yards or down the paddock, they're just causing absolute chaos, and you sort of half wish they'd stayed at home. But they're all different, you know, and this whole idea that everyone's got this idea that all farm kids are like Kelpies and they're all really keen to be out there doing stuff all the time. And they're not really, as a rule. Some families will get two of those and they think that every other farm kid should be just like their farm kid, and they've just rolled the dice twice and got the same number twice. Those of us that roll the dice multiple times tend to get a little bit of more variability. And we have a few of these different...
I'm nodding my head because, yeah, this sounds very familiar. Yeah.
You just have different ones, which is great, because I don't think I could handle five Jack Russells, and five Labradors would be pretty boring. So we've got a few bit of everything, and that's really good fun.
Yeah, and I think it's also okay to see that there can be that mentality of every farm kid has to love it and has to want to live this lifestyle, and that's how it's going to be. And a lot of them start out that way. I mean, all my kids, when they were little, they wanted to play with tractors and they loved the combine whenever it was in the yard and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes they stay that way, and sometimes they kind of grow out of it, because I mean, lots of little kids are obsessed with backhoes and dump trucks, but that doesn't mean that they're all going to end up, you know, working construction when they're older. As they grow and they mature, they end up interested in different things. And sometimes as a parent, I think they're, when you have the different kinds of farm kids, you can feel a bit of guilt, even feeling like, oh, well, I didn't raise the right kind of farm kid. And if they don't want this lifestyle, then I've done something wrong. But they don't have to want to do this. And, you know, fabulous if they do. But I know we've said in other episodes, like, the lifestyle is too hard for them to do it if they don't want to. And if they're not that kind of person, and this is not the career that they want, then it's also our job as parents to make sure that they can be successful in whatever it is they want to do. And that doesn't have to be agriculture.
Oh, definitely. I think we've taken the same approach with our kids. But I want to circle something back to something you said, Kate, earlier about the money. And it's about the dangers of living this incredibly frugal lifestyle on your opportunities to raise a potential successor. Now, we're of the mindset that if none of the kids want to take it on, we're going to have a one hell of a retirement, and there'll be huge advantages that we can spread quite equally amongst our children if none of them decide to do it. But if one of them, a couple of them really keen, well, we'll do our best to support them. But some families definitely do want a successor for whatever particular reason. And if they're living this life that's not fun, the kids aren't going to want to do it. So if being on the farm looks like living in a house that really is in desperate need of repair, that mum and dad work all the time, that you never have any fun, that there's no disposable income to do anything nice, that all of the equipment is run down and broken down and every fence needs mending, that's not going to be the life that they want. Because the opportunities outside agriculture become even more exciting and attractive than they do when you compare them with that sort of agricultural model.
And then that phrase of "this could all be yours one day" becomes a threat instead of a gift, right? The kids are like, "Oh dear, no, thank you."
Definitely. So I think there's, we do have to be really conscious of living a life that is enviable, that someone else might want to take on one day, and not just that sort of romantic ideal of what things could be like. It's actually, in practical terms, it means living a comfortable life. It means doing nice things. It means, you know, having extra work, extra volatility, extra all of these other things, but the trade-off is quite good.
That's a really interesting point, Carmen, because I feel like there's so much pressure to sell agriculture to non-farmers, which is a, it's a really important thing to do, but we also obviously need to be selling it to the people who are going to do it. And if we can't convince them that they want to do this, we're really going to be up a creek. You know, I mean, here there are no younger farmers because it's too expensive and it's too hard. And there's no reason to get back into it. You know, there's no, we send our kids off to college and there's no reason to come home and keep farming, which, you know, is really depressing.
Yeah, oh, most definitely. And as much as we talk about the challenges of succession and handing over to another generation, the people that are struggling with that are actually the privileged few that have got someone to come back, that wants to come back. And the people that are left entirely out of the conversation are those people, for whatever combination of reasons, don't have anyone that wants to come back. And we don't hear much chat about them. And often there's can be, you know, incredible sadness there and incredible and people that just wait and wait and wait and wait and wait, hold off their retirements in the hope that, you know, someone in, that's now in their 40s to 50s potentially decides that they want to come back to the farm, and, it, you know, it never happens. So there's certainly a lot there. There's definitely a lot. And it's that fine balance, I think, between when you've got kids at my age, you're doing everything you can so that if they do want to come back, that there's a productive, profitable farm there for them. But at the same time, we don't want to put any pressure on our kids to do that if it's not their calling. Because as you said, Arlene, it can be really difficult, and it's especially if you're not passionate about it. So, yeah, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it, really?
Katie, do you want to go ahead and do our county fair question? I feel like we've covered a lot of the things that we wanted to talk about today, so we can...
Absolutely. I'm going to interject the one other thought I had, which was that, Carmen, some families have cats and don't even have dogs, and that is also fine. But it's, you know, we know families like this who have that kid who just could not be less interested in anything related to the farm. And it causes so much, it can cause so much damage to the entire family. And it's got to be really frustrating. It's got to be really hard. But you can't take your cat out, throw it into a herd of sheep, and then get pissed that it won't work them. You know, you're going to have to find a kelpie somewhere. That's, you know, whether you made that kelpie yourself or you found it somewhere else, that's on you. Your cat didn't choose this.
Yeah, and I think we are stuck in these for lots of reasons, but stuck in these models of farm succession, which talk about handing things on to direct descendants, to children, and we don't have the frameworks involved or set up or established that really assist non-direct descendants that are still family members, so often cousins, so nieces and nephews, or non-family members, be they employees or neighbours, to assist them in somehow taking on some of this legacy. So it's difficult. I don't know about the cost of farming land in your areas, but it's got incredibly high here, far exceeding its productive capacity in terms of its ability to earn an income. And that becomes a huge barrier, I think, to lots of these things happening too. So... yeah, definitely a lot going on.
I know one issue we're having here as well, and I know I've talked to Arlene about it before, is that there's so much crop farming fence row to fence row and then ripping out the fence rows and cropping right over that there are no houses left. And so even if people wanted to come back, there's nowhere for them to live. And it's, you know, it becomes this whole thing. Anyway, county fair question. If you were going to dominate a category at your county fair, what would it be? And you can make one up if you want.
So we don't have county fairs. Ours are called shows. So we have a country show. And, yeah, they're still quite popular, actually. They're very, very good. Now, what would my category be? I think it would be childbirth, Kate. I'm a bit of a whiz, and I just kept getting better and better at it.
Did you say childbirth?
Yeah.
That is a new one.
Speed or what's your specific
Definitely speed. So I had one. Oh, this is a bit of a farm overlap question. So I was having my fourth and I rang my husband and said, look, I think baby's coming. And he said, oh, can I just finish spraying this paddock? I said, no, you can't finish spraying the paddock. You're just going to have to come home. So I rang his mum and she came down because she was looking after the kids, my beautiful mother-in-law. And then, like, he just stopped because he was coming up the driveway and ran into his cousin, who's also the neighbour, and had a big chat to him. And Sean said, oh, why was your mum just going sideways through the gate? Far out, she was tearing up the track. And he said, oh, God, Carmen's having the baby. And he said, oh, well, you better get going. And he came home, and I'm sort of, like, leaning over a chair in the kitchen going, oh. and then he's swapping vehicles around and everything else. And as it turned out, we got in the car eventually, went down the road, and I thought, I'm not going to make it the two-hour trip to have the baby at the maternity hospital. So then we just started making some phone calls. He called up local truck driver on the two-way, and I'm thinking, oh, fairdinkum, I hope he's not going to deliver my baby. And we just made it to the next tiny little town and called the ambulance and met them there and had the baby in the ambulance. So I had the baby 5 minutes after meeting the ambulance, so half an hour after leaving home. So that was one. Like, I would have got an award for that at the show if they'd given me one. And then 2 years later, when that category came up the next time at the show, I would have won again because I did the same thing pretty much again. But I thought, we're not going to go. I decided that driving 2 hours to the hospital was a stupid idea and that I had to go to.
Yeah, clearly it wasn't working out for you. Yeah, you're too fast. Yeah.
Wasn't working for me. And also, see, that was the private hospital, which cost a fortune. So I could go to the public hospital, which cost absolutely nothing. And I thought, I'd done all the work myself and still got the massive bill at the end. So I thought, righto, I'm going to.
Right, because the ambulance brings you to the hospital and then you probably had to pay for the ambulance too, did you?
Yeah. Oh, well, no, I think that was covered by the. Yeah, that was covered. But anyway, so I thought, oh, well, I'll go and have this next one at the public hospital, which is like only like an hour and 10 minutes away. And then got in the car again, thought, I'm not going to make it. An hour and 10 minutes. So we pulled into our local tiny little hospital, which, you know, just sends people off to emergency or gives old people IV antibiotics. And they do a great job, but they are not a maternity hospital. And I knocked on the door, we'll press a night buzzer and said, oh, look, I'm having a baby. They said, you can't have it here. Like without even looking.
Well, it's either going to be, on the sidewalk outside the hospital or inside.
Without even looking at me, they said through the buzzer, you can't have it here. You've got to keep going. I said, I can't have it here. Anyway, as luck would have it, we've got this beautiful Iraqi couple that are our two local GPs here. And Dr. Wiles said, oh, this is my wife's department. I will call her. So he called up his wife. He wasn't on call. And she's got a obstetrics background. So she told me that she hadn't delivered a baby in 10 years. And then the next day she told me she had. And I told her nothing's changed. It's still exactly the same as it used to be. And then the next.
Yeah. I delivered one 2 years ago and it's fine.
It's fine. Yeah. Yeah. I've got more experience than you've got. Recent. Anyway, she told me a couple of days later when I met up with her that it had actually been 20 years since she delivered a baby. But she did really well. And I'd managed to have another one in half an hour from leaving home. So that was good too. So that, yeah, I think I would have won 2 years at least. Yeah.
Yeah, that is very impressive for sure. So we will go ahead and move into our cussing and discussing segment. I imagine you could have used that for your cussing and discussing as well. So our listeners know that if they want to send in theirs, they can just call our SpeakPipe at speakpipe.com/barnyardlanguage. And you can leave us a voice memo there, or you can email us at barnyardlanguage@gmail.com. Katie, what do you have to cuss and discuss, cuss or discuss this week?
Working remotely and then having to leave the house.
Yeah, you don't want to leave the house again. Ever?
No, we just got notified of a week-long business trip to New York City for my remote job for a week in June.
So do you have to buy like real clothes?
Yeah, the office is literally in Times Square and there's like 90 of us meeting. And so I feel like our normal office dress code is, are you dressed?
Right, you're going to be on a Zoom call. Yeah, are you wearing clothing?
If you at least have a shirt on, I mean, I don't know how many of my coworkers wear pants. I don't care if they're wearing pants as long as I don't have to know about it. Maybe none of my coworkers have lower bodies at all. I don't know. Never seen them. But yes, I have the feeling that my normal sweats and a t-shirt or leggings and a t-shirt or occasionally jeans and a t-shirt situation is not going to super be up to snuff. And there's people out there, and gross. I like working from home. That is all.
Yeah. And traveling, planes, security, all that kind of stuff.
And just the rural BS of trying to explain, because I work for a big tech company and most of my coworkers are coastal, you know, or like big city people, that our nearest airport that won't take three stops to get to New York City is 3 hours away. So driving to the airport takes almost as long as the flight. And just trying to explain this to people that it's not that easy to just be like, it's 20 minutes away. I can take an Uber. Like, no, I can pay $300 for parking because there's no cheap option here.
Yeah, that's right. And the vehicle has to be away from my home for the whole time that I'm away too.
Yes, yes. This is my incredibly privileged rant because, yes.
You have to go to New York City. Okay, okay.
We have to. But I have to look and act like a respectable adult human while I'm there, which I don't think is fair. Anyway, Carmen, what do you have to cuss and discuss?
Well, can I do a positive one? Because I'm so excited about something that's happened. So we live 45 minutes from home. We're getting the groceries delivered.
Wow.
It's just started happening. And it's just like been a game changer because I'm like you, Kate, I just don't want to go to town. And they're just coming to my door and this lovely fellow carries them to the door. So even the bit, you know, the bit when you've got a lot to take out. I'm getting
from the vehicle to the house. Yeah, all the bags.
I will admit that last week our hired man helped carry the groceries in and it was amazing. Right up until I fell down the steps. But that's a whole nother, like, that was not his fault.
Oh. he didn't cause that to happen. That wasn't his fault, though.
No, he did not push me. So how do you get groceries delivered that far from town?
I don't know. It makes no economic sense at all, and it won't last. But for as long as it lasts, I'm really...
They'll figure out that this doesn't make sense yet.
They're going to figure it out shortly that they're making absolutely no money. Because it's not costing me anything. There's no fee.
They're waiting for you to get used to it, and then it's going to start being like $50 a pop, and you will pay it because it is worth it not to leave the house.
And I will pay it. I will pay it. The problem is that all the other town jobs that obviously aren't delivered are all adding up, and there's motorbike tires to be picked up and other stuff to be dropped off and all of these things.
Right, because, yeah, the groceries are the thing that gets you to town, and then you do the other stuff while you're there.
Yep. All the parts, but they can wait. So sorry about not cussing and discussing, but that's...
Isn't that why you have teenagers, though?
Oh, so mine can't actually drive yet. So we've got this really... So you can get your license in our state at 17. But so on 16, you get your learner's permit and you've got to do 120 hours of supervised driving before they can drive independently. So now he's dry.
Yeah, my 16-year-old just got his license, but it's basically a year before you can actually do a driver's test and drive by yourself.
Yeah, so it's the same. Yeah, but do you have to do how many hours, any mandated hours of practice or?
There's mandated hours to shorten that time up to 8 months. If you don't do a certain number of hours or driver's education, then it's the full year. So it just depends. Yeah, it's either the 8 months or the year, and then the driving hours are within that.
So it used to be you didn't have to do any, and now it's this 120 hours thing. And it's one thing where rural families have got a huge advantage because we're doing the hours anyway. But my urban cousins who would drive, you know, in their whole week, aside from their work commute, might be in the car for an hour total, really struggle to find the time.
Yeah, that would take a long time to build those hours up. And you're using a lot of gas to just go on random trips if you don't actually need to go somewhere.
So I've got a chauffeur for the next sort of 12 months, which is great.
Minus the stress of making sure they actually know the rules of the road.
Occasionally. And watching out for kangaroos and all the other things. So. Yeah.
Deer here, but yes, same. Look out for things on the road.
Yeah. So do the deer want to kill themselves? Because the kangaroos want to kill themselves.
Or they run into the side of the vehicle because they've watched you go past and still jump out. And yeah.
Yeah, we've got wallabies too, but they're very shy. So they'll just stick their head out and see you coming and think, oh, it's not a safe time to cross. But the kangaroos always try and make a run for it. So they've, and they're sort of just, they sort of vary a little bit in color from district to district, but it's always the sort of color of the native veg in the area. So they blend in so perfectly, especially yeah. at dusk. And
they're quite big too, right? Like, and they can do a lot of damage to a vehicle, I imagine.
Yeah, huge amount of damage. Yep. And to themselves.
Yes. Well, yeah, that too.
Arlene, I am taking this opportunity for a second cussing / discussing. Carmen, do you have flying foxes in your area?
No, we don't. No. Do you like flying foxes, Kate?
Bats are my favorite. And the idea of a bat that is the size of the average flying fox, it just sets my little heart aflutter. So I was just going to have an unholy amount of jealousy if you had flying fox, but okay.
Yeah, no.
Wallabies sound pretty adorable too, though.
Wallabies are cute. Yeah, they're lovely.
Arlene, what's your cussing and discussing today?
Well, on the topic of driving, I'm going to go with, I maybe have used this one before, but we're 3 years in, so I can't remember. Driving with teenagers, because in theory, this young person in my life, one already has her license and is a pretty good driver, I will say. We're now on number two in the driver's seat, and it's really stressful because sometimes there's a lot of confidence without skill. And sometimes there's a lack of actual skill, or just because in theory they know what the rules are, in practice that doesn't always turn out. And but trying to keep that veneer of calm so they don't, you know, crash into the ditch or something when you're actually afraid for your life is hard to maintain.
But it is funny, isn't it? Like, so we were driving down the main street, and this is probably my son's second or third voyage into town, and so he's quite a competent driver, having driven on the farm quite a bit, so he can handle the vehicle quite well. So there was a car stopped in front of him, so he just sort of went into the oncoming lane, you know, to overtake them on the main street. We'll just go around them. You can't do that, mate. You can't. Oh, why not? Like, obviously he's seen me overtake on rural wide roads before, but thinking that was...
Yes, yeah. Where there's a dashed line, that one's okay, yeah.
yeah, that's fine, but you can't do it down the main street.
Yeah, I remember one time as we were going through a stop sign being like, were you going to stop for that one? And they're like, oh, I didn't even see it. It's like, oh, yeah, small town driving, it was fine. There was no one actually stopped at that four-way stop, but would have been good to follow the rules of the road, but... Yes, it's all part of the parenting experience, I guess.
So you've got one down, three to go.
Yes, yeah. So number two is in the early days. So we're working our way through. So we want to thank you, Carmen, so much for joining us here on the podcast. If people want to find out more about you, about your business, about Australian agriculture, where should they find you online?
At agrifocus.com.au.
Perfect. Thank you so much. It was great to meet you.
Thanks, Arlene. Thanks, Kate. I really enjoyed the chat. It's been lots of fun.
Thanks for coming on, Carmen.
Thank you for joining us on Barnyard Language. If you enjoy the show, please support us on Patreon with a donation.
Big thanks go out to our show editor, Krista Paffrath at the Rural Podcast Network.
Please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen, and follow the show so you never miss an episode.
If you want to connect with other farming families, join the private Barnyard Language Facebook group.
We are always in search of future guests for the podcast. If you or someone you know would like to chat with us, get in touch.